Originally, of course, there would have been several massive outer coffins. These are missing, as are the masks. Those must still be in Pharaoh's original sarcophagus, covering the body of Tanus in the royal tomb that still awaits discovery. What we have left here is only the inner dressing of the royal mummy. With long forceps, he peeled away the top layer of bandage, as Von Schiller, perched on his block, grunted and shuffled his feet. "The pectoral mandolin of the royal house of Mamoz," Nahut whispered reverently. The great jewel blazed under the arc light, resplendent in blue lapis lazuli and red carnelian and gold. It covered the entire chest of the mummy. The central motif was of a vulture in flight, soaring on wide pinions, and in its talons it clutched the golden cartouche of the king. The craftsmanship was marvellous, the design splendid. "There is no doubt now," Von Schiller whispered. "The cartouche proves the identity of the body." Next they unwrapped the king's hands, clasped over the great medallion. The fingers were long and sensitive, each of them loaded with circle after circle of magnificent rings. Clasped in his dead hands were the flail and scepter of majesty, and Nahut exulted when he saw them. The symbols of kingship. Proof on proof that this is Mamoz the Eighth, ruler of the upper and lower kingdoms of ancient Egypt. He moved up to the king's still-veiled head, but Von Schiller stopped him. "Leave that until last," he ordered. "I am not yet ready to look upon the face of Pharaoh." So Nahut and Reaper transferred their attention to the king's lower body. As they lifted away each layer of linen, so were revealed scores of amulets that the embalmers had placed beneath the bandages as charms to protect the dead man. They were of gold and carved jewels, and ceramic in glowing colours and marvellous shapes, all the birds of the air and the creatures of the land and the fish of the Nile waters. They photographed each amulet in situ, before working it free and placing it into a numbered slot in the trays that had been set out upon the workbench. Pharaoh's feet were as small and delicate as his hands, and each toe was laden with precious rings. Only his head was still covered, and both men looked inquiringly at Von Schiller. "It is very late, Herr Von Schiller," Reaper said. "If you wish to rest..." "Continue," he ordered brusquely. So they moved up on each side of the mummy's head, while Von Schiller remained on his stand between them. Gradually, the king's face was exposed to the light, for the first time in nearly 4,000 years. His hair was thin and wispy, still red with the henna dye he had used in his lifetime. His skin had been cured with aromatic resins until it was hard as polished amber. His nose was thin and beaked. His lips were drawn back in a soft, almost dreamy smile, which exposed the gap in his front teeth. The resin coated his eyelashes, so that they seemed wet with tears and the lids only half shut. Life seemed to gleam there still. And only when Von Schiller leaned closer did he realize that the light in those ancient sockets was the reflection from the white porcelain discs that the undertakers had placed in the empty sockets during the embalming. On his brow the pharaoh wore the sacred uraeus crown. Every detail of the cobra head was still perfect. There was no wearing or abrading of the soft metal. The serpent's fangs were sharp and recurved, and the long forked tongue curled between them. The eyes were of shining blue glass. On the band of gold beneath the hooded asp was engraved the royal cartouche of Mamoz.
"I want that crown,"
Von Schiller's voice was choking with passion.
"Remove it so that I can hold it in my own hands."
"We may not be able to lift it without damaging the head of the royal mummy," Nahut protested.
"Do not argue with me. Do as I tell you."
Immediately, Herr Von Schiller," Nahut capitulated. "But it will take time to free it. If Herr Von Schiller wishes to rest now, we will inform you when we have loosed the crown and have it ready for you." The circle of gold had adhered to the resin-soaked skin of the king's forehead. In order to remove it, Nahut and Reaper first had to lift the complete body out of the coffin and lay it on the stainless steel mortuary stretcher which already waited to receive it. Then the resin had to be softened and removed with special prepared solvents. The whole process took as long as Nahut had predicted, but finally it was completed. They laid the golden uraeus upon a blue velvet cushion, as if for a coronation ceremony. They dimmed all the other lights in the main chamber of the vault and arranged a single spot to fall upon the crown. Then they both went upstairs to inform von Schiller. He would not let the two archaeologists accompany him when he returned to the vaults to view the crown. Only Uta Kemper was with him when he keyed the lock to the armoured door of the vault, and the heavy door slid open. The first thing that caught von Schiller's eyes as he entered the vault was the glittering crown in its velvet nest. Immediately he began to wheeze for air like an asthmatic, and he seized her hand and squeezed until her knuckles crackled with the pressure and she whimpered with pain. But the pain excited her. Von Schiller undressed her, placed the golden crown upon her head, and laid her naked in the open coffin. "I am the promise of life," she whispered from the ancient coffin. "Mine is the shining face of immortality." He did not touch her. Naked, he stood over the coffin with his inflamed and swollen rod thrusting from the base of his belly like a creature with separate life. She ran her hand slowly down her own body, and as they reached her mons veneris, she intoned gravely, "May you live forever." The wondrous efficacy of the crown of Mamose was proven beyond any doubt. Nothing before had produced this effect upon Gotthold von Schiller, for at her words the purple head of his penis erupted of its own accord, and glistening silver strings of his semen dribbled down and splattered upon her soft white belly. In the open coffin, Uta Kemper arched her back and writhed in her own consuming orgasm. It seemed to Royan that she'd been away from Egypt for years instead of weeks. She realized just how much she had missed the crowded and bustling streets of the city, the wondrous smells of spices and food and perfume in the bazaars, and the wailing voice of the muezzin calling the faithful to prayer from the turrets of the mosques. That very first morning she left her flat in Giza, while it was still dark, and since her injured knee was still swollen and painful, she used her stick as she limped along the banks of the Nile. She watched the dawn cobble the river waters with a pathway of gold and copper, and set the triangular sails of the feluccas ablaze. This was a different Nile from the one she had encountered in Ethiopia. This was not the Abbe, but the true Nile. It was broader and slower, and the muddy stink of it was familiar and well-beloved. This was her river and her land. She found that her resolve to do what she had come home to do was reinforced. Her doubts were set at rest, her conscience soothed. As she turned away from it, she felt strong and sure of herself and the course that she must take. She visited Duraid's family. She had to make amends to them for her sudden departure and her long, unexplained absence. At first her brother-in-law was cool and stiff towards her, but after his wife had wept and embraced Royan, and the children had clambered all over her, she was always their favourite, Amma. He warmed to her and relented sufficiently to offer to drive her out to the oasis. When she explained that she wanted to be alone when she visited the cemetery, he unbent so far as to lend her his beloved citron. As she stood beside Duraid's grave, the smell of the desert filled her nostrils, and the hot breeze fidgeted with her hair. Duraid had loved the desert. She was glad for him that from now onwards he would always be close to it. The headstone was simple and traditional, just his name and the dates under the outline of the cross. She knelt beside it and tidied the grave, renewing the wilted and dried bouquets of flowers with those that she had brought with her from Cairo. Then she sat quietly beside him for a long while. She made no rehearsed speeches, but simply ran over in her mind so many of the good times that they had passed together. She remembered his kindness, and his understanding, and the security and warmth of his love for her. She regretted that she had never been able to return it in the same measure, but she knew that he had accepted and understood that. She hoped that he also understood why she had come back now. This was a leave-taking. She had come to say goodbye. She had mourned him, and although she would always remember him and would always be a part of her, it was time for her to move on. It was time for him to let her go. When at last she left the cemetery, she walked away without looking back. She took the long road around the south side of the lake to avoid having to pass the burnt-out villa. She did not wish to be reminded of that night of horror on which Duryad had died there. It was therefore after dark when she returned to the city, and the family were relieved to see her. Her brother-in-law walked 3 times around the citron, checking for damage to the paintwork, before ushering her into the house where his wife had set a feast for them. Atalan Abu Sin, the minister whom Royan had come specifically to see, was out of Cairo on an official visit to Paris. She had 3 days to wait for his return, and because she knew that Nahut Gudabi was no longer in Cairo, she felt safe and able to spend much of that time at the museum. She had many friends there, and they were delighted to see her and to bring her up to date with all that had happened during the time that she had been away. The rest of the time she spent in the museum reading room, going over the microfilm of the Taita scrolls, searching for any clues that she might have missed in her previous readings. There was a section of the second scroll which she read carefully and from which she made extensive notes. Now that the prospect of finding the tomb of Pharaoh Mamose intact had become real and credible, her interest in what that tomb might contain had been stimulated. The section of the scroll upon which she concentrated was a description that the scribe Taita had given of the royal visit by the pharaoh to the workshops of the necropolis, where his funerary treasure was being manufactured and assembled within the walls of the great temple that he had built for his own embalming. According to Taita, they had visited the separate workshops, first the armory with its collection of accoutrements of the battlefield and the chase, and then the furniture workshop, home of exquisite workmanship. In the studio of the sculptors, Taita described the work on the statues of the gods and the life-sized images of the king in every different activity of his life that would line the long causeway from the necropolis to the tomb in the Valley of the Kings. In this workshop, the masons were also hard at work on the massive granite sarcophagus which would house the king's mummy over the ages. However, according to Taita's later account, history had cheated Pharaoh Mamose of this part of his treasure, and all these heavy and unwieldy items of stone had been abandoned and left behind in the Valley of the Kings when the Egyptians fled south along the Nile to the land they called Kush to escape the Hyksos invasion that overwhelmed their homeland.